open. Good morning, everyone. First announcement, Senate Bill 663 is not ready. So we're going to carry it over until tomorrow. We're going to start off with a public hearing on House Bill 2643. That is Kyle. He's going to give us a brief presentation. We have Representative Lively here to fill us in after this presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2643 is a bill that would make some changes to the enterprise zone exemption. So the B engrossed version that we have would authorize the designation of enterprise zone, electronic commerce zones, and electronic commerce city, and the reservation enterprise zone by zone sponsors. And the zone sponsors, those would be cities, counties, port, or tribal governments. The designation of enterprise zone and boundary change and zone subject to will be subject to determination of the Oregon Business Development Department. And they'll still oversee some of the certain statutory requirements, making sure those are met. It does require submission of documentation to Business Oregon before the designation from the local governments. They would still need designation from OBDD. And it would eliminate the numerical limit on the number of enterprise zones that may be designated at any time. So right now there is a cap, on the overall limit of 66 total enterprise zones. That would be eliminated in 2643. There's not going to be a change in the limit on the e-commerce, number of e-commerce zone or the one e-commerce city that's allowed. And that's important because there is a secondary effect on the income tax side for the e-commerce zone, so there is no change in those limits. And all the qualifying requirements of enterprise zones, the such things as unemployment rate and economic hardship in certain areas, those still apply. It's really the change in the overall limit and then also allowing the local governments to designate them rather than Business Oregon. But it'd still be Business Oregon will still have an oversight responsibility making sure that the new zones do qualify qualifications that are in statute right now. We do have the paperwork on this. There is no the minimal. We do have the fiscal is minimal, and then the revenue impact. There's no direct revenue impact, and that's because we've seen this a few times in some other bills. It is permissive on the local governments to create the enterprise zones. So by passing this bill, there would be no direct revenue impact. But if it does increase the overall number of enterprise zones, there could be some secondary effects there.
Okay, Representative Lively, and why don't you come up with your team? I also have Matt Smits and Doug Riggs.
Sure. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm state representative from District 12, which is essentially the city of Springfield. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss House Bill 2643. When I introduced this bill, I thought it was pretty simple, straightforward. I still think it's pretty simple, straightforward, but it appears other things have been talked about in relationship to this. But so my goal, simply when I started, was to allow local governments, which we're talking about enterprise zones and property taxes, and property taxes are local government's jurisdiction. And so my goal was simply that if local elected officials wish to make an argument that they needed to have an enterprise zone to create an economic investment leading to jobs, they ought to be able to do that whether there was a zone available or not. Right now there was 66, and if all the zones were filled, then they couldn't get a zone because there was limited by numbers. So whether the zone was available or not, and whether timing, because the other issue was that they only opened it up at certain times when those zones are available. And so what the intent was, and I still believe what the bill does, is if an opportunity presents itself in a community in Oregon and the local elected officials, be they city and county, decide that the working with the company that they need to use enterprise zone, which would waive property taxes for 3 or 5 years, they can do that subject to the rules that are already in place at the state of qualifying for the particular enterprise zone and then approval, having submitted that application to the Business Development Department. And as the law says, it requires 60 days notice. three things that are important. Having worked 30-some years in economic development, I can tell you timing is the most critical factor in economic development. I mean, you move when a business has the money and the time in which to do it. And so in many cases, again, especially in smaller communities, those opportunities come along rare, if ever. If they do come along, again, the intent here is if they come along and they aren't currently a designated enterprise zone, they could put an enterprise zone in place and take advantage of that opportunity. Given the fact that there's 66 enterprise zones already in place, we're not talking about hundreds of new enterprise zones. Heck, we're talking about very limited. Right now, we do have a case where there's five applicants for four zones. So in theory, right now, we have where all five applicants could be worthy and could deserve a zone. But since there's only four available, one of those applicants will not succeed. So the goal in the long term is just to prevent that from happening. When the opportunity presents itself, at the end of the day, those local elected officials are counted to those voters in those cities and counties that they're waiving the enterprise zones the benefits. So for me, it makes perfect sense. It does not change e-commerce zones. E-commerce zones has to do with income tax. A couple of years ago, we changed e-commerce zones to 15 in the state. That leaves e-commerce zones the way they are, so it only essentially all it does is removes the cap from 66 to allow the number of enterprise zones to be whatever would meet the needs of those communities at that time. I encourage your support. A couple things that we're not talking about whether enterprise zones, there's always this discussion about, so do they really work or they don't work, and we can debate that. That's not what this bill is about. I can tell you, in working in some of the smaller communities in the state, I believe strongly that in those specific cases, they have made a difference. That without that abatement, those private investments would not have been made. But that's not what this bill is about or what I'm trying to do at this point either. And so the long term of that, simple, straightforward, just get rid of the cap on the number of zones and allow communities to apply when the opportunity presents itself. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Let's these two gentlemen go first, and then we'll ask questions.
Oh, okay. My name is Matt Smits. I'm the chair of the Oregon Bioscience Association. Our mission is to cultivate a thriving bioscience ecosystem in the state of Oregon. And we strongly support this bill, House Bill 2643. And e-zones are, in our view, an important tool to incentivize companies to stay, to grow, and to be of influence here in the state of Oregon. And we have many activities ongoing in our community that involve, you know, starting new companies. The state is involved in signature research centers such as Otrati and Onami, making investments in those activities. Once they come out of those incubators, they have to have a place to go. And this is where other states get involved and try to recruit those companies away from Oregon. We have a few examples of that in our past. And it's a great opportunity for local jurisdictions at least to have a tool available to them in an economic development perspective to keep those companies in the state. And as well, some of our larger bioscience companies have the same effect where some of the facilities are outside of the state or sometimes even in other countries where local economic development activities are ongoing. And certainly those jobs that are being pushed for in our area would be – other areas would be happy to gain those as well. So the opportunity is here to remove the limit of enterprise zones in such degree that local jurisdictions can simply make a decision whether they are willing to pursue retaining and growing their bioscience companies and some of the innovations that are becoming companies over time. Timing is the issue. Like Representative Lively said, we just simply can't predict exactly when these events occur and when is the right time to do that. So therefore, removing the limit will help to make timing an important aspect of this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We are the nine cities in Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson County. And I will say that in the last 15 years, this program has been instrumental in maintaining some level of stability in small rural counties like Crook County and Jefferson County, which at one point unemployment was well over 20%. Functional employment was probably close to 30%. The Enterprise Zone program was something that was very interesting to us in at the beginning of the program. Many of my communities applied. We have four enterprise zones in Central Oregon right now. And we've taken advantage of that to be able to bring in businesses. I did want to refer, and if we could get up on the screen, there are some pretty clear criteria. And so I think what Representative Lively has come up with here is an innovative way to do it. On the Oregon Business Development Department's homepage, there's a set of criteria that is required. And so when he refers to the existing criteria, I think it's important to point out these criteria would prevent the program from suddenly everybody having an enterprise zone. It would really maintain the limitations. You have to increase full-time permanent employment by 10%. You cannot have concurrent job losses in other parts of the state, so we're not going to be pilfering from some other part of the state. These jobs must be at least 150% of the average wage, medium wage, in the area. You need to have agreement with other local governments. It doesn't specifically mention school districts. This came up at an earlier committee. But in my neck of the woods, we always work with our school districts to make sure that they're on board as well. So I think the criteria that exists in the department apply to these enterprise zones, by nature limit the number that are going to be out there, but also guarantee that it's a tool that's available. I echo Representative Lively's point about being able to react quickly when a job opportunity or jobs opportunity comes along. Many times our city councils or mayor or our economic development folks will get a phone call from a company interested in locating within 30 to 90 days or 180 days. And these are out-of-state companies many times that have a real interest in Oregon, but we have to be competitive with those other states, and we have a variety of tools in our toolkit to be able to do this. This is one tool that, if it could be cued to be a little quicker in the implementation, might be very helpful in bringing some of those out-of-state jobs here to Oregon and providing some good family wage benefits. So this is an excellent program. We've enjoyed a very good working relationship with the department, and we think this is a great bill. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So anybody can weigh in on this, but 10 years ago, we were looking at increasing from 10 enterprise zones to, I think, 15. And we were all very concerned about the areas that these got put in. They needed to be a depressed area, if you remember. And the other side of the discussion was, well, why don't we just make the whole state an enterprise zone? Mm-hmm. And that's, we're getting close to that at this point. So what's your take on whether we should be really opening this up to any place? Because that's really what this does. It's pretty clear that any place will suffice for an enterprise zone and meet the criteria. It's become, you know, what is the business going to do, as opposed to what is the need of the area. And so are we going to be taking away from those designated depressed areas by doing this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I don't think so. I think there are built-in limitations, as I pointed out. You know, we, in spite of the fact that the economy is recovering, a lot of the jobs that are being paid are fairly low-wage mm-hmm. jobs. And so from our region's perspective, any time we have an opportunity to get an employer who pays above average wages, that's good for the community. I think the built-in 150% threshold is very important here. And so I don't think we'll have an enterprise zone every place, because I think there's a limited number of businesses that can come in and meet the criteria. There's also a number of years limitation in here. It can be extended, but you know, not the businesses don't get the enterprise zone benefits forever in most cases. I think our general theory is that a rising tide lifts all boats, and this is going to be a limited tide. As Representative Lively said, there are only 5 applicants right now. I think if there was a demand to be entirely statewide, you'd probably see 20 or 25 or 30. And I think that trend will probably continue. It'll be a limited number of opportunities. It's an administrative chore for local governments as well, so this isn't something that just happens. You have to have the staff time and the justification, and have to meet the criteria. So I think there will be limitations.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. I'm actually in favor of enterprise zones. I always have been. I just want to be sure that we're not putting them places where they're not needed.
Right.
And the other thing I've become concerned about recently is when the counties and cities decide to do a property tax abatement, that they don't say, well, we need help now. Mm-hmm. So what's your answer to that problem?
Chair and Senator Riley, so a couple things about that. One, again, it goes back to, for the community to even apply, and it goes back to who would apply and it does everybody going to, they need to have an economic opportunity. They need to be able to make an argument that there's a reason why they would even do that. And so when you talk about whether it's so the communities that are left that don't have enterprise and zones in most cases are the most depressed, the most in need, because they haven't had those opportunities, so they haven't been able to in the competition to be able to make that argument that they would most likely be able to take advantage of it. So one of the reasons, again, I think that's important is those are the communities where the local officials need to have those conversations, and if the opportunities are there to do that. Secondly, since it is, from my standpoint, it's important to have those local conversations about the potential impacts of property taxes and that. The city councils, the mayors, the county commissioners are all elected by those local citizens, and so that's where that conversation ought to be taking place. That's not to suggest, you've got to remember, there are other tools besides enterprise zones currently available through the Business Development Department. You know, we have grants for public infrastructure and loans, so there's a lot of other tools in that toolbox besides that are already available that in many cases are part of when a community makes an argument for an enterprise owner of the business, that they also apply for those. So I don't anticipate that changing. In many cases, it's multiple things. Many deals I put together included special public works grants, included ODOT monies for highways, and that were all part of the package that the community helped them in. So I don't think that'll change. I don't see it leading to a lot more asks than already out there.
But as you point out, some of the most depressed areas don't have enterprise zones.
That's right.
And part of the reason for that, in my view, is that we give enterprise zones to places that don't need them. And therefore, those depressed areas can't compete. They have trouble competing anyway, and that's why we created enterprise zones, is because those places that can't compete need some incentives. And if we give enterprise zones just because a company wants to locate someplace, that's not the purpose. The purpose is to help those depressed areas. So I have a little problem with what we've done with enterprise zones up to now, because we put them in places that don't need them, simply because there's an opportunity. And if those opportunities were to go to those depressed areas, I'd be much happier. I'm not opposed to this bill. I'm just pointing out that some of my problems with the whole concept and where it's gone. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see something done to help those depressed areas that aren't getting these enterprise zones, because the places that are getting them are getting them simply because some business wants to move there. So those are my problems, but I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you very much, Mr. Thank Chair.
You. Senator Buckwitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Senator Riley, I'm completely in favor. Excuse me. Completely in favor. I appreciate Representative Lively coming forward, but like Senator Riley, I think a few things we need to make sure are on the record. I'm in agreement with Senator Riley for a slightly different reason than the enterprise zones, because my observation is the reason they didn't get to depressed areas, the depressed areas don't have money to go through the whole bureaucracy to get them. So therefore, yeah. I'm with him. We have a problem with enterprise zones and that. I think Representative Lively points out correctly that, you know, this is really business timing and location. And it's first the business wants to locate. There is a location. Many times, you know, in my experience, the businesses that are trying to do this sort of thing are actually going to depressed areas because there's labor, which means there's labor for the business. And then the problem is timing is just totally impossible, because by the time you get done with the bureaucracy, the filing, and 25 years later, you get this sort of stuff. And we started this decades ago in the land use side. And so I think my really specific question for the representative is that, as he has found out for those of us who are revenuers on revenue and finance in both chambers, is that you start out with a good idea, and by the time everybody gets done with it, you're at the B or the A version, and then you're at the B version. And then you wonder whether or not the original version has gone. And I just want some assurances or comments from Representative Lively that, you know, it is the B version, which means they took your really good idea and either went better or worse or added bureaucracy. And so I just want to ensure you're satisfied that this will solve the timing issue, because we have this elsewhere. We have some other bills in this committee. This is exactly like this, and I'm with you. I mean, we need to do something to get the economy moving. So are you happy with first the A and then the B, and you don't want us to tamper this with this and make it a C?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist. I am happy with the B. So the big difference from what was originally, the original one had another aspect that dealt with some timing or some value in enterprise zones that was also in e-commerce, and that became confusing because people thought we were changing the e-commerce zone rules, and we're not. So we just took it back out in order to make sure there was no crossover. So it's really back to where we started. There are some other cleanups in the bill that I think will help with the timing issue with Business Oregon that they've learned over the years, too, from a standpoint of that. But I agree with Senator Riley. At the end of the day, one of the problems remains on some of these smaller communities that have the choice is the bureaucracy you talk about or how they do that. And I spoke just briefly with a representative from the League of Oregon Cities here before we came up. You know, that's something I'd love to work on, because there are some things we can do, I think, in addition, didn't get time to do it this time, in addition, that would help them, and it's not just financial things, but help those smaller communities meet that timing and help to put together ultimately the deal on that. But I believe I'm very supportive of the bill in the form in which it's at right now, and appreciate it just passing in that form.
Senator Boquist.
Well, you might get an opportunity, because we're working on a similar bill trying to help this same thing. But just for the record, and I'm really not sure whether it's Representative Lively or one of the two of you want to jump in, but I would like to have on the record, what is our expectation of that timing? If the opportunity came up to City X in rural Oregon for Business Y to come in, what is your envisionment of the timing process? They're going to, for better word, as we all know, show up at the city planner and say, hey, we're thinking you guys might be a good fit for us, but they have a time schedule. What are you thinking, 90 days, 6 months? What is the timing expectation you have of this process through fruition to say, yes, we can do this?
Chair and Senator Boquist, so first there's a 60-day notice to Business Oregon, so we've got to have the 60 days there. I think we will have failed if it takes much longer than 90 days in that from the time they go. And so depending on the city and or the county, they can take action pretty quickly at the local level. Elected officials can do that. Then it's a matter of all the paperwork, and that's where it becomes problematic. But so my goal would be that the fact that that could happen at the local level, that the local elected officials would make a decision quickly. They'd get the presentation, decide what it is, and so they would say, yes, we're in favor. Still has to go to the state and to do that. But what I've found working in economic development in cases, that at that point at least, it gives comfort to some of the companies that they'll take a little bit longer. So it's going to take 120 days. It's going to take even longer than that to get to the final deal. But if the local elected officials are on record that they're willing to take the battle, meaning they're willing to go forward and ask for the enterprise zone, that in often cases can happen fairly quickly, which will send the signal then to the company that there's some comfort that we'll get this deal done and they'd be willing to work with them. So that to me is the most important part, that they can do that and have some assurance. And since there's no restriction on the number of zones, some assurances that they meets the qualifications that they'll get the zone.
I think I can concur with that. That's sort of like the scenario. Once the wheels are rolling for particular companies to notice that there's economic development incentives and opportunity to stay rather than seek the growth and the scale up of a business elsewhere. Once that signal is placed, that usually means that there is this period in which the details are hashed out, and then the company makes a decision to stay. But we've seen on a couple of occasions some companies in Bend, some companies in Portland, some companies in Southern Oregon who simply decided to move out of state because they were not able to find the resources, some of it talented, some of it economic development, to really justify staying. And that's a concern, because then we become an innovation state that really produces a lot of good ideas, but we can't hold on to them. And we never really get to a cluster. We never get to really an ecosystem such as in other, you know, other areas of our industry that now are really blossoming, like outdoor industry, you know, semiconductor industry, and so forth. If we play off of those strengths, we can build a brand new industry as well in that regard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looks like it's 4 to 6 months is the ideal range, for the record. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment briefly, I think we've hit on a couple really important points, and I view this as one element of a strategy to get us back to being economically viable in rural communities. I mean, there are two other issues. Infrastructure is a huge issue and a huge concern for cities, and there's a bill, House Bill 2435, that is in Ways and Means that would provide some infrastructure funding for local communities to put in infrastructure to be able to prepare. I think that's really important. The second area is workforce, and I know we're having a discussion on CTE and vocational education, but having a workforce that's able to meet the needs as well. So you have to have kind of all those factors working together for a successful economic development package.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. This discussion is very similar to the one we had 2 years ago when we increased the caps, and it's really and 10 years ago, and it is that issue. Every time you add more,
we were on the same committee.
We were on the same committee, and you're diluting the more you add. And so, it's not to say we don't support this, but it does beg the question that I think Dr. Warner raised earlier about a state enterprise zone and mm-hmm. how far away we are from that. So,
sure.
But thank you for coming.
Thank you.
There's no one else here to testify on this bill, so we'll close public hearing on 2643. And I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2150. Schools. Dave.
Chair House, members of the committee. House Bill 2150 comes to us first from education and then House Revenue. Got very strong support on the floor with minimal opposition. Most salient features of the bill was worked out in House Education, and then House Revenue actually worked to cut fiscal on the part of ODE. So this bill, if you look at the examples, there's a couple of fixes, very important fixes. So if you can make it a little bigger. So the first fix is when so let's focus on the example on the left side. That's first fix. So school district A has charter school and non-charter schools. And in school year one, we have 500 and 500 altogether, 1,000 ADMW. And so then what happened was in school year two, 100 of non-charter school ADMW moves to charter school in the same district. The way under current law the ADMW is calculated, we use extended ADMW. So non-charter schools extended ADMW is still 500 because we take a bigger of the two, between 500 and 400. Charter schools, with the addition of 100 ADMW, it becomes 600. So altogether, the school districts will get 1,100 ADMW.
Why does it go to 600?
Because it gets additional 100. So what happened was, on top, actually, Paul, if you move a little up, so 100 ADMW transfers from non-charter to charter within the same school district.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens is in the second year, 500 plus 100 becomes 600 for charter school. But altogether, ADMW altogether, extended ADMW becomes 1,100. But for the school district, the obligation of teaching kids actually is 1,000. But then because of the way the ADMW, extended ADMW is calculated, this school district will get 1,100 instead of 1,000 ADMW. The same works, the same mechanism works if the kids from charter school moves, kids moves from charter school to non-charter schools or vice versa. So it works both ways. The school districts, instead of getting 1,000, from the state perspective, school district A is teaching 1,000 ADMW worth of students. On the other hand, because of the way it is written under current law, mm-hmm. this school district will get 1,100, so 100 additional ADMW funding. That's going to dilute the entire statewide revenue per ADMW.
Okay, sorry. I think I thought I knew what was going on here, but maybe I'm just confused by this chart. First of all, you're talking about a non-charter school is a non-charter, just a regular public school, right? Okay.
Yes.
So why does it go to from 500 to 400?
Okay, so let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
In school district A, in school year one, ADMW is 500 for non-charter school, and charter school, 500. Now, 100 worth of ADMW transfers from non-charter to charter within the same district. So for the school district, school district A is teaching 1,000 worth of ADMW kids.
Is that because of the 80% funding thing, or are you?
No, it has nothing to do with it.
Okay.
No, sir.
I still don't follow why the non-charter school goes from 500 to 400.
Correct me if I'm wrong. So I think this is the answer to the question. If I remember my formula education back when Chuck and I were doing this, is that we calculate there's still 1,000 students in the entire district in year one and year two. Under present law, correct me if I'm wrong, what happens is the greater of the amount of these 2 years is where the ADM funding piece comes from. So even though you still have 1,000 in 1 year and 1,000 in the second year, under charter schools, if one moves to the other, they get the greater value. And it's similar in the second one, they get the greater value. So instead, you calculate, you pick one of the 2 years, which is the greater value in one of the categories. So it ends up making it look like you have 1,100 students. And this bill's fix is to ensure that you're only counting for 1,000 of the students in the district, regardless of where you go.
Yeah, exactly.
You're double counting. 100.
You're double counting because the formula allows you to use to your advantage the better of the 2 years, and so you can claim you have an extra 100 people when you don't for that year. That's the problem with the extended floor mm-hmm. formula.
Okay. Right. So, thank you, Senator Boquist. So what happened was, under current law, the extended ADMW of non-charter schools and charter schools are calculated independently of each other. Instead of just calculating the extended ADMW for the entire school district, 2011 law changed the way ADMW is calculated. So charter schools will come up with its own extended ADMW. Non-charter schools will come up with its own. Combine them, that's under current law. So instead of 1,000 kids, that's just like Senator Boquist mentioned, they are getting 1,100 kids of funding, ADMW funding. So that's 100 is double counted at this point. Now, what this bill does is it doesn't allow that. It prevents that from happening. So what happens is, okay, school district A, you're teaching 1,000 kids. You're going to get the funding for 1,000 kids. No more, no less.
If I may, it's because they get to choose from the 2 years, which they which they use. So if they move during that year, they each choose the best, which is when they get to count those 100 students.
Right.
So if they move, they both get to count those 100 students, one in year one and one in year two, and they get to choose which year they use to count.
Exactly. So what happened was, under current law, non-charter schools get to choose the higher of 500 and 400.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes 500.
Yeah.
Now, charter schools will choose the bigger of the two. It's 500 and 600, so it becomes 600. Altogether, school districts will get the funding based on 1,100 kids. Now, this bill fixes that so that the school districts, regardless of charter schools or non-charter schools, the students are students. There's no distinction. So you're going to get the funding based on 1,000 kids because your kids move from from charter schools to non-charter school, vice versa. Students are there. They didn't change.
Yep.
You get the funding for 1,000.
Good fix.
Okay. That's the first fix. And the second fix is probably about $30 million worth of fix per year. So what happens is, think of a very highly mobile charter school moving from one school district to another. Mm-hmm. So school district B has, just for the for simplicity of discussion, we're going to assume that ADM and ADMW are the same, approximately. So school district B has 500 of non-charter schools, kids, excuse me, and 500 of charter school kids. So a highly mobile charter school actually moves from school district B to C. So in the second year, what happens is school district B has 500 kids. School district C has 500 kids. So altogether, from the state perspective, it is 1,000 kids we're educating. Under current law, though, school district B gets to choose the higher of two ADMs, 1,000 and 500. So it becomes 1,000 still. And of course, school district C would get the funding based on newly admitted students. So from the state perspective, school district B and C altogether, they're teaching 1,000 kids. The state has to provide funding based on 1,500. That's going to dilute the formula revenue per ADMW. Entire school districts will get less funding because of this additional 500 double counting. Now, this bill fixes that. Now, there is actually cost of closing a school, charter school. So for that cost reimbursement purpose, this bill allows 5% of prior year's ADM as distribution to the school district B that's losing the mobile charter school, and allow the school district to use that money to help with the closing cost. And in case there is cost overrun, there are additional appropriation that can be tapped into, but that's 3%, but that's a contingency account that can be used, may not be used. If there is money left over, will be transferred to general fund after a while. So the fix in this case is, from the state perspective, the entire ADMW becomes 1,000. Just there are 1,000 kids. So 1,000 kids will be educated. There will be no additional 500 funding, 500 kids funding. that was double counted. So it does two important fixes. One, by treating charter school kids, non-charter school kids, the state doesn't lose the state doesn't dilute the formula revenue per ADMW. And then second, in case for the case of a very highly mobile charter school moving from one school district to another, if under current law, the state would have to dilute formula revenue per ADMW by about $40 to $44 per ADMW. Because of this fix, the state's burden is only about $2 per ADMW. So this current law is a consequence of 2011 legislation, and now this fixes to perhaps two unintended consequences from that law. By the way, I mentioned that House revenue went through some change so that the fiscal is cut in half on the part of Department of Education. So that's the essence of the bill.
Mr. Chair, are there amendments?
We have some, if not before the committee, on deck. Day, have you seen any amendments?
We have -B10 on all lists that we received. The essence of that amendment is when when there's a charter school closure in one school district, when its size is not too big, that can be observed within a big scheme of educating students, then we allow current extended ADMW applies. That's just creating exception in terms of extended ADMW calculation. So that's the essence of B10.
What is that? What effect does it have on bottom line?
Did a rough calculation. It looks like looks like there'll be additional, probably minimum 500 ADMW dilution. So 500 times 7,000, it's like a little over $3 million dilution in formula revenue.
We have an amendment I know that's coming that would remove the emergency clause. Can you give us the effect that would have?
So I think that we'll have to change a lot of things within the bill, because the second fix actually is the movement of one online charter school from one district to another. That's a probably very important fix, and involves a lot of money. And that part has to be written separately from removing emergency clause, because the language in the bill is written with the specific mention of 2015-16 school year, and a lot of things have to be changed. And ODE fully anticipated this change, and probably they've implemented some of the changes already in anticipation. Now, I am concerned about that part too, actually. So I can't fully assess at this point the impact if we remove emergency clause and implement the whole change by keeping the second fix intact, probably over 1,000 ADMW minimum dilution. that means about 7 million violation of the entire formula rating.
Senator Boquist?
My observation is because I'm in possession of a B10, that would be the B11. So I guess for staff, my question is the removal of the emergency clause actually sounds to be a substantive issue. Was this issue not discussed on the House side? And is the presumable B11 removal of the emergency clause a reversal of what transpired in the House, or 11th hour, 11th amendment is my question in the waning hours of the legislature. So is this an issue that's been discussed before? It sounds rather complex.
Senator Boquist, actually, Representative McClain mentioned on the House floor debate that he has some concern, although he voted for the bill. And probably the product of his concern is B10.
Correct. Well, my concern is the bigger slice of pie that's substantive, which is would be the theoretical 11 of removing the emergency clause. This sounds like a reversal of one of the other amendments or one of the discussions in the revenue. I guess my real question is, did House Revenue try to address this issue of the emergency clause and its immediate impact?
In House Revenue discussion, we had, because the salient features were worked out in House Education, what we did was we heard the bill and we worked to cut the fiscal. That was what we did.
Okay.
No other discussions actually were there.
Thank you, sir. I'm only asking because every time we touch ADMW, it's just like a political nightmare.
Yes, it is. So, Chair Hess and members of the committee, I guess we'll have to go through probably wholesale change in the bill to make it work. It's just not a matter of just removing emergency clause. Probably we'll have to work out some other details so that we can keep the second fix intact and address removing of emergency clause. At the same time, we have to work with ODE about their fiscal too. So that's my rough reaction to removing emergency clause.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I know for the record that it's Representative McClain who's the proponent of the B10. I mean, I have an email, and that's from there. And I would have assumed he would have come and before the committee, or somebody would have come before the committee with whatever that. As the proponent, whatever that is, and I would assume if it's a substantive change in the B11s that some proponent's going to come forward and take ownership of this, because like I said, ADM and school formula is paramount to political suicide at times in this building. Somebody needs to be behind this, I guess.
Senator Edwards?
Huh?
Do you have a question?
No, I was going back and just checking what Dave was saying about the mechanics of the bill. Yeah.
All right. Gary Temple is here.
Yes, it looks like you're being thrown in.
Yes. All right, Senator Hass, members of the committee, my name is Gary Temple. I am the superintendent of Scioto School District. We would certainly be one of the districts affected by this bill. I thought Michael would come up and explain in more detail of the bill, but I was actually here to talk about the Dash 10s. There are actually other unintended consequences if those were to go through. But essentially, this bill fixes what happened in 2011. So in 2011, the thinking was that if districts' ADMW was calculated separately from the charter school, that would encourage more districts to sponsor charter schools because their ADMW would be held harmless. That's not how it worked out in reality. What we really needed to fix was the charter school rate. and how that's calculated. This bill puts all that back together. So what happened was some unintended consequences of districts converting to charter schools and getting double funding. And so this now calculates all the funding back as a district total the way it was prior to 2011. The second piece of this bill is to correct something probably we never even thought of, and that's the hold harmless amount that goes to a district when a charter school closes. So, for example, let's take a regular bricks and mortar school. Let's take my third grade. Half of my third graders leave for whatever reason, right? Currently, we would get, and even under this bill, we would have gotten the hold harmless amount. I have 50 in a grade level, so we would have gotten the hold harmless amount for all 50 of those third graders. And that amount of money was to help us downsize, right? It was a one-time replacement of the funds we had, and it was to help you downsize because you don't necessarily get to go fire a teacher in the middle of the year. You may have to combine grades. There are lots of things you may have to do. Well, in the case of a charter school, what we have been doing is replacing all of the hold harmless money when that charter school leaves. What we failed to consider is most of that money was already going to the charter school. That's not money we need to replace. So does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the second part of this bill then would address that very issue. And in our case, well, in all cases, would be 5% what was calculated for the closing costs of the charter school. There are actually kind of three things we have to consider when we're closing the charter school. We have the closing costs, we have what we were using for money before that was in our budgets, and then the long-term kind of glide path out of this. This bill, in its original form, only addresses the closing costs. Now, to the dash 10s. The dash 10s create a unique situation in that it would treat one district this year differently than all other districts. And I would tell you, I never advocated for 100% of the funding, not one day. That wasn't a responsible thing to do. We wanted no part of creating additional hardships on districts because of our situation. But uniquely, the dash 10s create an unbalanced situation. So for example, if Lebanon School District were to have a charter school of 1,000 and they were to close it for whatever reason, under the dash 10s, they would now get 100% of that hold harmless money. Conversely, if LC would have sponsored the exact same charter school, they would get 5%. And so my ask of you is, whatever we do, whether it's 5%, whether it's a cap, we do the same thing for all districts and treat us all the same. And so, you know, if you're compelled to work the dash 10s, what I would, ways to fix this would be you could have a cap. You could pay up to 200 students ADMW or 500 students, whatever you picked. But that would be a way to limit the amount of hardship, for lack of a better word, on the state school fund, but still give some protection to those districts that are closing small charter schools. The dash 10s don't treat the hold harmless amount based on the size of the charter school. They treat the hold harmless amount based on the size of the school district. And that's really not the function of the closure cost. So with that, I take any questions.
Oh,
boy. Like yeah. I said, you may not know the answer to this, or you may not want to answer this. If ODE can come up and answer this question. But I'm just, okay, if I'm understanding correctly, it's a one-time, one-year fix. Last time I checked, one-time, one-year equals some name. So there's a school district someplace.
Guess what?
That is this school district, and there are costs associated with closing this particular school, that's my assumption. Can you shed any light on that, since I have no...
Okay, so I'm going to try...
And if you don't want to and you want to punt to ODE or somebody else...
I'm good, but Michael may be able to expand more on this. So there are actually four charter schools that I know of that are closing in the state this year. Three So one is moving by its choice. So in our case, they found a better deal and have moved to a new district. In the other cases, they were closed for various reasons, but not because they were moving to a new district. Now, I think I'm honing in on your question, but I'm not sure if I'm hitting it yet. So when ODE calculated the 5% for closure costs, so for example, we'll be laying off 9 people that were doing the special education for the students that went to ORCA. Those people will be laid off at the end of the year. Some of those will get jobs, some won't. We will have to keep the records, and in an online situation, this is huge. So we will have to keep the records of all the students that they've had that have left their school for the next 75 years. So if you can imagine this, we have built a climate-controlled room where we have put fireproof file cabinets. So I'm anticipating, so we already have 30 fireproof file cabinets that will hold the IEP records. Those I have to keep until those students are 25. And then we anticipate up to 30 more file cabinets that will hold all of these student records of the students that have left ORCA, because they do not have the right to take those to Mill City with them. There will be staff time in all this closure, dealing with different issues that we're going to be dealing with probably for years. But am I honing in on your question?
Right. I'm trying to figure out the expenses and who we're talking about. Exactly.
So what, when ODE...
And you have told me something I never knew, so that's actually good.
Okay. So and when ODE figured this, what they did is they called districts that had closed charter schools, and they came up with a range of 3 to 8%. And so they picked 5. Now, I will tell you that we spent many hours together in a room as we tried to work through what I think are our costs and where we're headed and what our future looks like. And they went beyond the call of duty to work this out with us.
Okay. All right. Just as a few minutes ago, we had the 11s, which were... requested by Senator Johnson. They're on OLIS now. While you're here, Gary, this removes the emergency clause. I don't know if you want to weigh in on that, but
yeah, and I don't know how that would affect us or not affect us.
Yes.
That's okay. Further questions for Mr. Temple? Thank you.
Yep.
The department is here. I don't know if you want to weigh in on this. We might have some. I think Senator Boquist has some questions, because he always has questions.
I had the same question, but he got there, and that's great.
Mr. Chair, I just try to ask as many questions as possible to save my colleagues in the majority from being. The thing, Mr. Chair, can you like shed some light on your department? And then the E clause, obviously, I mean, and no one wants to name this, and so therefore you're the state agency. I mean, it's still not clear to me. There are obviously significant costs involved, and there are obviously specific schools and specific school districts that we're trying to figure out how to preserve the records for 75 years, which I now understand. Can you explain?
Senator Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb, the legislative coordinator for the Department of Education, and with me is Michael Elliott, the State School Fund Coordinator. Mm-hmm. And so we've been following this bill as it's moved along. And, Senator Boquist is correct. This is a complicated issue, made more complicated by the amendments. And we will want to actually look at the amendments before we weigh in on what their effect will be, because it'll depend on which sections are affected. And with that, Michael, did you want to talk about the particular school districts that are affected?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, again, my name is Michael Elliott, State School Fund Coordinator for Oregon Department of Education. Mr. Temple is correct. I know of 3 charter schools closing this year and 1 charter school opening. The charter schools closing are the Oregon Connections Academy. They're moving from SIO to opening in the Santiam Canyon. I believe Corbett Charter School is closing this year as well. Will be closed in 2015-16. The Insight Charter School of Crook County School District, they will be closing. And the Vernonia Charter School, Vernonia School District, is looking to move most of its students to a charter school format. So based on the emergency clause, I'd probably like to reserve a significant impacts and how that's going to affect the bill when I can take a look, because as legislative revenue staff indicated, we need to see what's emergency, what's not, when does implementation take effect, when doesn't it take effect, does the emergency delay implementation, does it not. And while I appreciate the emergency clause has just been removed, I'd like to have a chance to play that out through the bill and see how it goes. But I'm happy to answer additional questions. The Dash 10 amendments appear to affect the Crook County School District, that they would fit the criteria of being five times their non-charter students' weights being five times greater than the charter student weights. And the Insight Academy closing is between 400 to 500 weights, and I believe the Crook County School District is around 2,000 weights. So what would happen is the 500 weights in the Crook County School District, those would remain as 100%. They would get all 500 weights, and districts like SIO would get 5% of their weights as a grant paid to. I would be remiss if I didn't say that would potentially significantly increase our fiscal impact, because now we're doing programming for separate districts, which is hard for our system to do. So there would be an impact to the department if the Dash 10s were adopted as well. I don't know the official impact. I'll need to talk to our information technology people and programmers to get a good idea of how much it would take for them to do that programming. And if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't need an answer now, but I mean, as I said, you know, anytime you tamper with ADMs and this formula, it's like a nightmare. But could you get back with me on the specifics? I mean, I understand the ADMs and the weighting, so on and so forth, but obviously, I mean, the intent of the bill is to try and hold harmless or finance the closing of these schools and charter schools or transfers at some value in the future, now calculated at 75 years. I don't think I quite understand that portion. And if I could just get you to touch base with me outside of the committee room so I can understand, what are those costs? I mean, why, you know, what's the difference between 3% and 8%? And obviously, if you're required by law to keep records for 75 years and it costs you 8%, you're getting 3%, something's going to happen to the records, which we want to protect those students. So I'm not sure I understand the dynamics, but in simplified form, I'm sure outside this you can explain it to me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you for coming up. Without formal invite or preparation time.
Thank you.
We were told that Senator Johnson will come
he's
down.
He's here now.
He's in the audience.
I'm sorry. Senator Johnson. Senator Johnson, you know we're talking about 2150 and your amendment, which is about 5 minutes old.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16. I feel like I've stepped into a conversation that is already underway, and I understand that a question about Vernonia had arisen before the panel already. Vernonia has an application at this point to be considered as a charter school. And bluntly, were that to happen, we could close the books on the fundraising for Vernonia. I'll take you back to 2007, where three schools were washed down in the Halem River. I, along with a committee, took point on trying to raise $40 million to replace those schools. We were able to accomplish that, but it required taking two cool school loans. And once there were little rear ends and little seats, our fundraising urgency, our case statement disappeared. We opened the school in September of 2012 in order not to break faith with the community that had stepped up and passed a $90,000 bond to help pay for the schools. But once the schools were opened, we had lost our urgency. And so commensurate with the direction that the school district was heading, seeing an opportunity for Vernonia to close the books on what has been now a multi-year effort. Vernonia has an application pending. It would have been considered last week. The Board of Education declined to act on it, awaiting the outcome of House Bill 2150. And I am before you to ask consideration of a five-minute-old amendment to take the emergency clause off the bill.
Senator Buckwitz.
I don't understand.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Buckwitz, I'm not sure I do either. I understand there are an enormous number of moving parts to this bill, and to be truthful with you, I'm having some folks call plays in from the sidelines that I'm not sure what overall gross effect they would have on the bill. I understand you may not move the bill today. That will give me a day to get a little more clarity around trying to help Vernonia's situation to get the cool school loans paid back and to close the doors on fundraising for Vernonia. But I understand there are lots of moving parts at this point in time, and I'm not sure that I can knit them all together in a unified picture for good, thoughtful policy consideration. I readily admit that.
Senator, just so I understand, make sure for clarity, the issue, the general issue that I think I understand is Vernonia School District is contemplating or has a request in to move to a charter school model.
That is correct.
Then, and what we're really talking about here is then what are the consequences, unintended consequences, and the financial trail behind it for that application were it to proceed. I think it's a great idea, but there are financial consequences here that
I want to be, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, I want to be clear that the movement to a charter school was commensurate with the natural resource-based curriculum and general direction that the school was taking once the new facilities were opened. However, this was an interesting target of opportunity, frankly, to see whether or not Vernonia could achieve the charter school designation prior to the implementation of the House Bill 2150.
Okay. Senator Johnson, I think you just answered this question. Was that the driving reason to make this change to a charter school, is the natural resource curriculum?
It was. The whole school is based on a natural resource theme, and we had, during part of the fundraising, a timber industry campaign. Vernonia was once the home to the largest electric sawmill in the world and draws heavily on its roots. Not only its physical location, and it's interesting because, as I frequently do, flying between Astoria and Scappoose, you fly dark, 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 hit Vernonia, and then dark, 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 all that dark is trees. It is surrounded by productive forests that are integrated into the curriculum as part of a natural resource education endeavor. And so the concept of capitalizing on the natural resource, both heritage and culture, and also preparing students in the natural resource disciplines had been contemplated by Vernonia. It's now this timing situation that comes up, driven largely by your consideration of 2150.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just hope the drought doesn't burn it down this year.
Your words in God's ear, Senator Boquist.
Tillam McBurn.
One quick one, Mr.
Senator Riley.
So do I understand that the entire school district would become a charter school? Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, so I don't think there's anybody who doesn't want to help Vernonia, given the history here. So we're going to take a few days to let this breathe and get some new input on what this does to the planet.
Thank you very much. It will give me a chance to breathe as well and to help figure out where all the moving pieces are, because I understand that this is a bill that may be picking up a lot of passengers as it moves through the building.
We've got a few of those. Senator Boquist.
Just so I know, I mean, Senator, just a guess of, you know, how many students are actually in the district? How many students were really affected here?
About, I am guessing, 650.
Right, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your courtesy, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2150. I'm going to go into a work session on Senate Bill 80. And try to get Dr. Warner and others to update us on where we are in that. This is the cleanup bill on the higher ed changes.
So, Mr. Chair, as you recall, you had a work session last week on Senate Bill 80, and you had looked at the dash 3, which was 288 pages. Mm-hmm. And the dash 4 we got at 8 a.m. this morning, it's been scaled back to 287 pages.
Okay, so, that's what we wanted.
so that's an efficiency measure. We have not had an opportunity to go through this. Our understanding is it's been, as you recall, the players involved, the universities, the Higher Education Coordinating Council. It's designed to be a companion to House Bill 3199 on the House side, which has now gone to Ways and Means, which really focuses on some of the bonding policy issues. But it is a follow-up in terms of duties and responsibilities from your major higher education reform bill from last session. So we think we're getting close. We just don't have the paperwork yet on the dash fours, and so we'd be working on that today and hopefully have that ready for your consideration tomorrow.
Okay. Well, let's carry over Senate Bill 80. If there are no questions.
I did receive a May 5th letter from the Treasury, and I don't know if it's in OLS or the other committee members received it. It was an answer to the question in short that, you know, if they go broke, we are liable at some level. So, and I don't know if any of the other members receive a copy.
Okay.
Are you using that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. No other questions. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 80. Clears our decks for the day. We are adjourned. Okay. Adjourned.